This last November in the Mark group. And let me just start like this. What constitutes the ending of the Gospel of Mark has long been a matter of dispute. It's one of the chief issues of textual criticism. There is, of course, a little shorter ending that doesn't even have a verse number, which says the following: "And they announced briefly all the things which were commanded to those surrounding Peter. And after these things, also Jesus himself sent out through them from east unto west the sacred and imperishable kerygma of the eternal salvation. Amen." Now, with the exception of one manuscript, and a Latin one at that, any manuscript that has this little shorter ending after 16:8 also has the longer ending. So because this is so, it seems to me that there are essentially three choices for the ending of the Gospel of Mark. You can say that it ends at 16:8. You can say that it does not end at 16:8 and that the original ending has been lost. Or you can say that it doesn't end at 16:8 and we should be appending verses 9 to 20, which is generally known as the longer ending. Now, there's an important book you should become aware of in this issue. And it's by a man named Clayton Croy, and it's called The Mutilation of Mark's Gospel. In this book, Croy lays out the negative argument for the fact that Mark ends at 16:8. He is against that idea, and he says that there are a number of reasons why it cannot be so. Two of his reasons are fatuous, and I won't even talk about those, but he's got about six others that are pretty good. First, he says, 16:8, ending as it does with the conjunction gar, is unlikely to be the final verse because this conjunction is unlikely to be the final word of a sentence, a paragraph, and especially of a book. Second, if Mark ends at 16:8, it would be a wholesale departure from Christian tradition, which strongly emphasized the resurrected Jesus appearing to the disciples. Third, the story could not end with the women silent and afraid, for then Mark could not have known the story of the empty tomb, which he clearly does. Four, Mark has prepared his reader for a different ending, because, and here we quote Robert Gundry, Mark has repeatedly and in detail narrated the fulfillment of Jesus' other predictions as far as those fulfillments occurred during his time on earth. Five, if Mark ends his gospel at 16:8, he defies the general expectations of ancient storytelling. And six, the presence of alternative endings, like the little short one or the long ending, shows that the ancients were dissatisfied with an ending at 16:8. Now, you can't simply dismiss all of these reasons. The vast majority of manuscripts do contain the longer ending. Manuscripts of every text type in traditional terms, Alexandrian, Caesarean, Western, Byzantine, do contain the longer ending. And the geographical distribution of the manuscripts is also good as well. More importantly, though, it seems to me that what's been on the scene lately is the suggestion not that the long ending is correct, but rather that the ending has actually been lost. And in fact, this is the tack taken by R.T. France. David Lewis referenced this commentary in his presentation earlier today, and he points out that at the end of a codex, it would be easy to lose a page or some pages. I would like to alert you to a more sophisticated version of this. It's by J. Keith Elliott of the University of Leeds, who believes that both the ending and the beginning of the gospel have been lost. And he feels that the first verse, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, is kind of an add-on and that the beginning in media res there with just the appearance of John the Baptist actually is just as stark, says Keith, as the ending would be at 16:8. Abrupt ending, abrupt beginning. And so the idea there is, if you had a codex, maybe the two outer leaves were missing. But I think that the arguments for ending at 16:8 are also strong, and in fact stronger, and that's what I'm going to be promoting today. Now, text critically, of course, we know the arguments that several major manuscripts like B and Aleph support that. However, what is not so well known is that some manuscripts actually discuss the problem. Manuscripts of family 1, for example, say this at this point in the text. In some of the copies, the evangelist fills things to the full up to this point, up to where also Eusebius, the follower of Pamphilus, drew the line. But in many, also these things are presented, and then follow 9 to 20. Perhaps more important, manuscript L and manuscript C, two very important manuscripts for Mark, I believe, include this comment. Also, these things, 9 to 20, are presented after the words Ephabuntagar. In other words, the manuscripts themselves are aware that there's kind of an issue. So the notion, for example, that most people have that all of the manuscripts except 4 or 5 of them just go blasting right from 16:1 to 20, that's simply wrong. Second, there's interesting patristic evidence. Eusebius of Caesarea discusses the ending of Mark specifically in his letter Ad Marinum to a gentleman named Marinus, in which he says, as he argues about supposed discrepancies in the resurrection accounts of Matthew and Mark, he says the following. At any rate, the accurate ones of the copies define the end of the history according to Mark with the words of the young man who appeared to the women and said to them, "Stop being afraid," and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. For in this way, just about in all the copies of the gospel according to Mark, the end is defined. So in this letter, as Eusebius is discussing it, he contends that the majority of manuscripts actually end at 16:8, at any rate, skedon in the Greek, the ones that are akribe, the accurate ones. Now, and then that's kind of the text critical thing. Now, linguistically, it's not impossible to end a sentence with gar, neither a paragraph nor a book either, and Croy himself admits this, but what he tries to do is say, yeah, you can do it, except it's in a different kind of literature. But in fact, he does have examples of something ending with gar. Finally, at this point in the paper, I would like to address what I think personally is the big issue in the room, and that is this, that literarily it wasn't likely, common in the ancient world to end a book like this. It's sort of an ending noir or something like that that just is sort of 20th century, and it's not really an ancient thing. It's atypical. Well, here you should know about a book by a guy named J.L. Magnus, M-A-G-N-E-S-S, called Sense and Absence, Structure and Suspension in the Ending of Mark's Gospel. What he does, Magnus does in this book, is to detail a number of pieces of literature in the ancient world in which suspended endings at the end of a book are actually in evidence. I would like to point out to you, I took a couple of his examples and then started doing further in-depth research on them. And I think that a couple of plays of Euripides are particularly helpful here. Euripides' Medea, in which the death of Medea and Jason's children is reported, but the death is not portrayed, and their bodies are only spoken of, they are not seen. But also instructive is Euripides' Iphigenia at Aulis. This has a very interesting potential suspended ending. Iphigenia, Agamemnon's daughter, must be sacrificed by her father to obtain fair winds for sailing to Troy. And she declares herself ready to die for the Greek cause. And I've got a bunch of line numbers here if you want to take a look at that. She exits the stage to the praise of the chorus in lines 1510 to 1531, with neither a description nor report of her death occurring as the denouement. And it seems that that open ending has occasioned additions of other possible endings to Iphigenia at Aulis. So, for example, David Kovacs, an editor of the edition I consulted, says this. Here at line 1531, in all probability, is the end of the play as it was presented at its first performance. The rest is probably a later addition meant to bring the play into agreement with Iphigenia at Tauris. That is another one of Eusebius' plays. In this latter work, Iphigenia at Tauris, Iphigenia recounts how Artemis took her from the sacrificial pyre, replacing her with a deer, and took her to the land of the Taurians to serve her. Lines 1532 to 1629 describe these developments in Iphigenia at Aulis, with, it can be noted, problems of internal consistency, language, and meter. And it's also interesting to note that there is another little short ending that is also possible for this play. So you have a very interesting parallel. And by the way, one thing that's very interesting about the parallel between the two Iphigenia Euripides plays is that Iphigenia at Tauris was written first, and Iphigenia at Aulis is the second play. It's actually right at the end of his life. So I think that there are textual, linguistic, literary evidences to end it at 16:8. What I want to focus on, though, today, is there any literary evidence inside the Gospel of Mark that suggests that the story can legitimately end at 16:8? I think there is. But in order to argue this, I want to say a few words about whether or not, and I think this is the second huge question, whether or not Mark is a literary production at all. The two questions that stalk each of them like a bête noir through the discussion is, one, nobody in the ancient world ended with an open ending, and two, Mark's not really a literary piece, and you're giving him this ending, this suspended ending, and that ain't that kind of book. It's just not that high literarily. So now we're turning to this second question. Most people say it's not a literary piece. It's basically a redaction-critical assemblage of sources. So you might say, rather than literature, it's source matter, according to most people. There is, in fact, a book by Meagher, which argues precisely this. And his book has the interesting title, Clumsy Constructions in Mark's Gospel. Now, I think a close reading of the Gospel of Mark suggests just the opposite, namely that Mark is a highly literary piece. I did an analysis of Plato's Phaedo and the Greek of the Phaedo, especially the Greek of the death scene of Socrates. And if you take a look at something like the death scene of Socrates written by Plato, the parallels between the Greek of that text and the Greek of Mark are absolutely remarkable. Especially worthy of note would be the following constructions that are very typical of Mark and also of Plato in the Phaedo. Object, verb, word order, with the objects coming in front of the verbs. Strings of nominative participles in predicate position. Nominative participles in predicate position placed after the main verb. Repeated use of chi as the basic connector. Extensive use of imperfect tense forms for basic narration. A syndeton, that is, no binding words like de or chi or gar. A syndeton, especially in discourse. Autus in the nominative as the personal pronoun. And actually, gar in an aside, in asides, such as we find in Mark 16 about the stone where there's this aside, for it was very large. Those kind of asides occur also in Plato's Phaedo. Furthermore, a careful analysis of Mark's style shows you that it changes subtly at about the halfway point of the gospel. No one has ever noticed this before. So the style of the first half of the gospel is slightly different than the second half as Jesus approaches Jerusalem. In the first half, set principally in Galilee in the north, it is characterized by verb, subject, word, order, the use of the adjective oithes as an adverb immediately, and predominance of chi as the main conjunction, all of which are Semitic features. The second half, set on the road to and in the environs of Jerusalem, is more distinctively Hellenistic and is characterized by subject-verb word order, declining use of oithes as an adverb, greatly increased use of de rather than chi as the basic conjunction, split syntax, where you take a noun and an article and then the adjective and article are split off from it in a more complex way. Strings of participles, eon as an alternative to on in dependent clauses, and the use of the classical form fa, he said, to convey formal statements. Fa does not appear until chapter 9. So if you look, and by the way, let me just say, it's like a sea change. It is not such abrupt a change as between Luke 1, 1 to 4 and verses 5 and following. It's not that abrupt. And I would say, I like to describe it as, it's sort of 70, 30, 30, 70. You've always got contravening arguments, evidence that you can put the other way. But if you look at it in toto and in general, there is a sea change that takes place around chapter 8. Now, if Mark's gospel is a literary piece, should it be read in an isolated way or should it be read intertextually? I am going to argue that it ought to be read intertextually against other sources. Now, what would be proof that Mark should be read intertextually against other sources? And it's not, so to speak, a gospel de novo that people read in isolation as if they confronted it for the first time all by itself. Well, consider a verse something like Mark 1:14a, where it says, "After John had been handed over, Jesus went away into Galilee." What's that, after John had been handed over? There's nothing in there at all about the betrayal of John. There's nothing about who he got handed over to. Nothing about the significance of any of this. You have to wait till chapter 6. So it's sort of assuming you know something about the story. Do you know it from oral tradition, or do you know it maybe from knowing the other Gospels? Or consider Mark 1:13. "He was with the wild beasts." Should we be seeing that against the background of Ezekiel 34, 25, and 28, which speaks of the people of God dwelling unharmed with wild beasts? So is there kind of a canonical matrix that should come to mind? I'm thinking that essentially Mark is to be read against what you know about the story elsewhere and in an Old Testament general literary context. So, if the work is a literary piece, and if it is to be read contextually, intertextually, is it not possible, indeed is it not more than possible, that Mark's gospel is more than standard, that he could form his story creatively, that he could dramatize the characteristics of the actions of the tale, and that he could manipulate the ending of the tale? I am arguing that that is exactly what is happening, that Mark's gospel is not a standard treatment of the story. It assumes you know a standard treatment of the story. It is a drama on the tale, a twisting of the story. It is a first century Jesus Christ superstar against the background of the greatest story ever told and King of Kings, both of which were produced long before. It assumes you know the basic tale. It is to Matthew and Luke what Wicked is to the Wizard of Oz, a retelling of the tale with a literary and rhetorical goal in mind. So, if we read it against the background of the other Gospels and against the background of the Old Testament and against the background of the early church, what is it that we see? What's the main thing you ought to be getting out of this Gospel? Well, most people believe that Jesus is the one who walks upon and leads his disciples en to hado to stauru, in the way of the cross. Jesus triumphs through suffering and the cross, saving his life by losing it, and he calls his followers to do the same. Read almost any commentary in Mark, and this is what the book of Mark seems to the author to be about: the way of the cross and calling you to that. I believe that that is only the penultimate story or message of the Gospel of Mark. It's not what it is essentially about. If you read Mark against the foil of depictions elsewhere, then what you see is a stranger and more fascinating picture, a different, strange, and fascinating tale and protagonist. The story of the second gospel is a story of ambiguity throughout. The protagonist is divine. He casts out demons. They call him the Son of God. Yahweh says, he raises the dead as Yahweh says that he himself would do. He walks on the water. But he's also a frail human being. He gets angry when his opponents resist his work. He is ignorant when his garments are being touched. He cannot do miracles in his hometown when people do not believe. The plot is Janus-faced like this as well. A voice declares from heaven, "You are my beloved son." The crowd is dumbstruck at his deeds, and they say in chapter 7, "He has done all things well." Yet his family thinks he's crazy. They try to remove him and they try to get him back home. And the disciples wonder, say, who is this that the wind and the seas obey him? So you keep having this kind of two-faced view of his person and of the plot. So, simply put, here in the second gospel, we see a story hard to follow and a hero difficult to understand. Therefore, we cannot see clearly and believe, like the guy who was healed the first time and could only see men like trees. Or as summarized by the Jewish leaders at the cross, and I think this is a key verse in the Gospel of Mark contained in no other gospel, 15:32. "The Christ, the King of Israel, let him come down now from the cross, in order that we may see and believe," which is exactly what this gospel will not give you. That is, seeing to believe, clear sight to understand. Rather, in this gospel, you must believe even though you don't see. It's the other way around. It's not seeing in order to believe. And so, just from this verse, you should not be surprised if the ending of Mark is at 16:8 without seeing the resurrected Christ. But that's not the in-textual proof that the book ends at 16:8, as good as that verse is. That occurs in chapter 8. You know the story. It's the tete-a-tete between Jesus and the Pharisees concerning a sign from heaven. Have you listened to this story? Have you listened to it against the foil of Matthew and Luke? In Matthew, Jesus gives this reply. A wicked and adulterous generation seeks a sign, and a sign will not be given to it except the sign of Jonah. 16:24. In a different context, here's what we have in Luke. This is a wicked generation. It seeks a sign, and a sign will not be given to it except the sign of Jonah, 11:29. But in Mark, this is the text. Why does this generation seek a sign? If a sign will be given to this generation, I'll be damned. There will be no sign. And Jesus is right in this gospel. In the Mark and tale, no sign will be given. There will be no concrete vision of the resurrection. All there is report. The report of the young man encountered at the tomb who says, "Stop being frightened. You seek Jesus the Nazarene, the crucified one. He has arisen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you." This maintains the ambiguity of the storyline. There is no sight. Evidential surety does not exist, but there is a word. A true word, Mark would tell us. A word of which we can be sure because it is founded upon the word of him whose promises in this story are true and ever sure. This promise answers to Jesus' prediction in 14:28, "But after I arise, I will go before you into Galilee." And it builds upon many other promises, most notably the passion predictions, but also who they would encounter when they entered Jerusalem and as they prepared to do the Passover and all that kind of stuff. There is promise after promise within the mission of Jesus, and they all come true. So nothing could be more perfect for the purposes of Mark. So in conclusion then, what is the message of this book? In my view, it is this. In this age, the reign and rule of God in Jesus Christ has come in power, but hiddenly, as it were, in humility and lowliness. The goal of the ministry of Jesus was to serve, not to be served, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Therefore, the true revelation of the Son of God was at the cross, as he gave his life as that ransom. Jesus promised a revelation of his triumphant self after the cross when the disciples would see him clearly. Just as they did not see him clearly immediately, however, and only had his promise and the word of the young man, just so we do not see him and the kingdom of God fully implemented and manifested right now. We do not first see and then believe, as the Pharisees were demanding. We have only his promise in his word. It is difficult to be faithful on the basis of the word alone, yet that promise is always sure. There will be a full revelation of the glorious risen Christ, but for now we can only believe the witness of the Word. And if I might just say, I would like to put this in the context historically, what I think is the historical context of Mark, written to the Christians at Rome who were perhaps undergoing persecution in the Neronian persecution, and they were thinking, in my view, something like this. In this time of persecution, we want to be confessors of the faith. We are not ashamed of the gospel message, but it would be so much easier to endure if we could see some proof or sign. If only we had been there when Christ walked the earth. If only we had been there in the ministry. If only we had been there on Easter morn. And the answer of the second gospel is no. It was always this way. It was always you had to believe the word of promise. Thanks very much.